Welcome to the Modern Therapist Guide to Nothing.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's the Modern Therapist Guide to Nothing, the podcast where we analyze stories and we frame them in the... This is horrible. I totally forgot my whole
We're not
thing.
Telling any stories today.
Wow, I totally forgot that.
It's like the only episode.
I'm really thrown off, Greg. I am really thrown off. I'm going to tell you why.
Okay, tell me.
Well, we got some news yesterday that's really shook me to my core. And Greg, I'm pretty sure you're pretty shook too.
I'm presently shaking.
So, turns out, we're probably going to have to do a name change, which isn't a huge deal, except it's going to totally disrupt our intro.
Yeah, that's about it. Is that it?
Only our intro and in our social media, but that's an easy change.
Okay, so I'm significantly less shook.
So what this means for us and for you listeners is we will be changing part of our title, as it turns out it's pretty similar to another title, which we didn't really realize. And we didn't realize how big of a deal that is. So now we realize that, and hey, it is what it is. We'll do what we got to do.
It's kind of one of those chicken or the egg scenarios. But in this case, it's quite clear which one came first, and it was theirs.
And that's fine. You know, that's fine. Sometimes you come up with a name and you think it's great. And then someone tells you, hey, we had that name as well. It's just a little different. Yeah. And we also trademarked that name. So, okay. All right. Touche, sir.
Yeah. Touché. You can have it. We hated this name anyway.
Last episode, I jinxed it. Last episode, I literally said, Greg, do you ever wish our name wasn't so long?
I was like, no. Well,
we're going to make it longer, probably.
Yeah, probably. We'll screw it up. But we will make sure no one else has that name. So I think that's, you know, we've got that out of the way. I feel a little better. I feel that I got that off my chest. And I want to talk about what we came here to talk about today.
Yeah.
And that is, it depends on how you want to say it, generational or intergenerational trauma, which is essentially the effects of trauma are passed down from one generation to the next. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I also heard it called the generational curse.
Ooh.
In some communities and, you know, populations. So this is a concept that I feel like has really gotten legs over the past couple of years. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. So the only thing that, and maybe we could talk about at the end, is the only thing that I've heard a lot about this early on when I first started school, but they called it cultural capital. And it was something that was the sort of the opposite of what we're talking about today. It was like, you know, social assets like education, intellect, just the way you dress, the way you talk, and how that can shape your future. So it was almost like the positive side of this. But what we're talking about now is how...
You know, can we come back to that theory or that thought later? Because that is going to tie into something that I am going to talk about.
I'll run it back
later in the podcast. You're going to remember?
I'll remember.
You promise?
Yes.
Wow, I am so not confident in that. All right.
So why don't you start us off, Dave? You're the expert.
Yeah, why would you say that? I'll just start off with the American Psychological Association's definition of this. Phenomenon in which the descendants of a person who has experienced a terrifying event show adverse emotional and behavioral reactions to the event that are similar to those of the person himself or herself. All right. It's wordy.
It is wordy.
I'm not even sure if I read that and I didn't do any research, not sure I would even know what that means.
Right. You did dissociate it a little bit. So it's like there's a family or a group of people. It's not that, it's that, you know, the way they're treated or the way they see the world shapes them for generations.
Yes. So the thought here is generational trauma, unlike, you know, a typical trauma happening to a person, isn't experienced by just one person. It extends from one generation of people to the next.
Okay.
It kind of is the concept of how trauma affects generations of people versus just like an individual person or like a couple of people.
Which makes perfect sense. Because
it's literally in the name.
That's right. And it's like, when you can imagine, if something happens to a group of people or a family, then those people are changed. The way they see the world is changed.
Sure.
So they pass that on to their kids. They pass that on, you know, because it's
such an easy concept once when you say it. And like, that's why I'm like, you have this wordy definition, it makes it seem so convoluted. But when you just say it the way that you just phrased it, it's like, of course, right?
No doy.
So how
does this manifest, Dave? Like, what does this look like?
Let me start off with the idea of historical trauma.
Okay.
So traumatic events that are shared amongst a group of people within a society, community, ethnic, or national group. So we're going to talk about some of those traumas a little bit later. But these can sort of manifest in issues such as like substance abuse, suicidality, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, anger, violence, difficulty with emotional regulation, all these types of things. And you know why, Greg, it can manifest in these ways?
No.
It's how people cope.
Right.
So, you know, it's like conditions are poor, our treatment is poor, and we cope through substance use. We cope through depression and anxiety, and we get low self-esteem because it feels like we're not going to be able to help ourselves, which then goes into an idea called learned helplessness.
So before you move on, let me just say something, because this is reminding me of something I would definitely forget. It's reminding me of something I read early on, and not even for this podcast, talking about generational trauma, but it was that the children of Holocaust survivors.
Yes.
Now they are like something like 300% more likely to have anxiety and depression. And you can imagine what, like, the world view of someone who experienced and survived the Holocaust, how they would teach their kids, and probably not even implicitly. They probably wouldn't sit down and be like, now look, the world's super dangerous. These things can go wrong. This can go wrong. But they probably live in such a hypervigilant, traumatized state that they pass that on to their kids. And their kids are like, yeah, the world is a nightmare. And they don't even, and it's never even spoken.
Yeah.
You know, it's just through osmosis, sort of.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up. I know we're going to probably touch on the same exact theme 1,000 times in this episode, but that's exactly what we're talking about here. Earlier today, I texted you. I said, did you ever hear anything about, you know, the idea that DNA changes from generation to generation because of generational trauma? And that idea is sort of, from my understanding, that idea has sort of been thrown out. Like, that DNA doesn't necessarily change, but what can, or seems like a more plausible idea, is that certain genetic aspects or DNA can be more expressed. It can be utilized for individuals who experience trauma as like a response, right? A trauma response. And that can more or less be like passed on. Like, you're more likely to get that gene expressed.
So even if like a scientist was standing in front of me saying, hey, the science doesn't add up for this DNA stuff, I would think, like, from an evolutionary standpoint, why would that not make sense? So this bad thing is happening to this person. So that's like basic evolution. So to be prepared for it the next time, there has to be some changes biologically to be prepared for that. That makes perfect sense to me.
So I'm listening today. I'm listening to things about generational trauma. I'm listening to all this information. I'm on a walk and I pass by squirrels.
Oh God.
And they see me. And as soon as I get close enough to be threatening, they run away.
Yeah.
And the first thought that came to my head is they are so shook, kind of like Greg when he got this news about our podcast name change. But I'm like, that's passed on. That's like, it's almost like, it's this instinct, right?
Right.
And is that from like early ancestors who were, you know,
like, prey? Like early Lazots, like kicking squirrels from generations? Well,
they're just hypervigilant all the time, right? They're constantly evaluating for threat. When you watch a squirrel, the way they move, they're just, and then, you know, this is a weird analogy, but it was like a thought that kind of came in my head. It's like, is that how, like you said, evolution happens?
Right. And I think that, I'm glad you brought up squirrels, because they're actually not shook, because they don't have, so their anxiety works the way ours is supposed to work, where they see Dave coming, they get the hell out of the way, and then they're back like picking up acorns, like they're not thinking about it anymore. Yes. So our problem is we have this this trauma or this thing happens. And then we have the ability to overthink it and think about it and think about it and think about it. And somehow be constantly thinking about it where that we pass that down. So they pass it down in the right way, just through instinct and evolution. We pass it down through like core beliefs and irrational thoughts about the world.
And you know, the other like way we pass it down that is not helpful is we don't express ourselves at times, mm-hmm. right? And for some, that's like a cultural thing. That's a family thing. Like we keep our, you know, we don't talk about our emotions. And that's really problematic for future generations that don't learn healthy ways to cope. And then they just do what they've observed their parents doing, you know? And that's kind of what we're talking about here is these passed on maladaptive ways of coping.
And you got to think like, this has got to be the way that stereotypes are developed in cultures.
Sure.
Like these things that, have they have developed to in some way protect them. And then on some level it becomes maladaptive and then people judge them for it. Or it looks right. like things like racism. It looks like abuse. And that's how these things start through irrational core beliefs that have changed through, you know, passed down trauma.
I completely agree with that. You know, back to one of the things that can manifest, I mentioned the low self-esteem and depression. And a lot of that is from this thing called learned helplessness, which, Greg, I'm sure you're familiar with, right?
Yeah, that's like my middle name.
Learned helplessness.
Yeah.
So it's this perception that, like, no matter what a person does, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do to change a situation for the better. So they're going to be permanently stuck in this negative space that they are living in.
Yeah. I mean, we see that all the time with people who, you know, maybe their family, like I had this one person in particular where his mother collects on SSI and so does his father. Yeah. And so that's all he's seen in his entire life. And now he collects because of, you know, depression or severe anxiety or whatever it is. But it's like he's decided whether rationally or just through seeing, he only knows what he knows through what he's been experiencing his entire life. So he thinks that he can't do anything because he's never seen it done. I mean, is that sort versus, of what we're talking about here?
Versus the idea that he gets on it because it's like, well, you know, I've done the math and it's probably more efficient for me to do it this way. And, you know, this is the support the family needs. He's doing it because like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do because there's nothing I could do differently or better.
Right? Or maybe I think he has super limiting beliefs about what he's capable of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
for some people, they just, like you said, they can't see any other way. Out. Yeah. And I think that's really, that can be a real problem. I also was thinking about, and I hope this isn't overly controversial because that's not my intention, but you know, some of the rallies I've gone to, it felt like you saw more allies than the people that were being represented at the rallies. And that part of that is also the area we live in. You know, there is diversity, but it's not the most diverse area.
What do you mean by that, allies?
So like, people that aren't the group of people that are, you know, are the protest is representing. So like myself was an ally for a few of the protests I went to. And I was thinking about this idea of learned helplessness. And I was like, this kind of makes sense in that way though. Cause it's like that idea, like why bother?
Right.
What is it going to change anyway?
Okay.
And and that's not great. Right. That's a really limiting belief, right? That's kind of this depressive mindset. Like what can I do to change anything? It doesn't really matter. Nothing's ever going to get better.
Yeah.
And nothing does change if nothing changes, right, Greg?
Right. That's absolutely. 100%. Yeah, we do.
So I just, that learned helplessness piece is I think a big one for this and that low self-esteem and that idea that like we can't better our own situations.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There's also this other thing that I think is a really interesting concept that happens in communities too, called internalized oppression. And that's basically oppression towards other members of the same marginalized group. So it would be for instance, the African-American community.
Okay.
It might look like the idea that being closer to white would be more acceptable or more desirable, right? So like lighter skin would be the ideal. And you see that in like different groups and populations. And I think it's such an interesting thing because even amongst oppressed populations, you have even more oppression amongst each other. almost there's something like a pecking order or like some kind of ladder, right?
Yeah. So Dave, and like, you know, if we're both trying, yeah. And I'm going to say this because speaking about the Black community and oppression, and it's like right here, and I don't even know exactly how to articulate it, but just something feels so like wrong or colonial times about it. And it's this idea that, you know, Chad Brown or the Brown family name represents two very distinct things in this state. So, I mean, it represents education, right? Because we have Brown University. It's this like Ivy League school, but also the name of like a project is named Chad Brown, which is the same family. And so on one end, it represents like higher education. And on the other end, it's sort of representing oppression, right?
Yes. Yep.
And so it's like, if you think about what were the things that were limiting the Black community hundreds of years ago when the Brown family was slave traders, right? Like, what was it? It was like, you know, healthcare, education, breaking up families. And then if you look at that same area now, it's in those projects, there's a lot of those same things happening. And it's like, I don't know what the solution to that is. All I know is something feels very wrong about that. And politically, it's like, there's what's the answer for that? Like, what are people doing about that? And I don't know. So I just noticed that and can point to it, but I don't really know. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's a great point that you're making, and it's such an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, there's something there that maybe we could dig into. Yeah, it's like, how can that same name represent something that's supposedly positive and something that's horrific? In the same city.
Right.
You know, it's just something weird and disturbing about that.
So there is one thing that brings to mind, and this is kind of goes into this internalized oppression. It's that idea of like having to distance yourself from your own community in order to ascend in society. And in a way, Brown University kind of represents that.
Yeah.
So if you think about the stereotypical student, it would be really hard to imagine somebody that lives in a project going to like application process or, you know, an interview and being viewed the same as somebody that like that like stereotypical Ivy League student, right?
Right.
So it's almost like in order to be that, they would have to distance themselves away from their own community.
But to even distance themselves from their own community, I mean, we're assuming that this is a level playing field, which is sort of unfair. Sure. And the thing is, you need something we talked about oddly earlier, cultural capital, which is like a social asset. You need a family name, you need education, you need the way you dress, the way you talk. That all has to come from passed down. Maybe it's not generational trauma, it's generational something though. But what's going on here? It's like saying that, you know, you always hear that argument that people, you know, I'm going to talk about Appalachia. This is the same thing though, where it's a less affluent community. And to say they have the same chance is like saying, that would be like, say we're all playing Monopoly. Do you remember that we did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're all playing Monopoly and we started off with $1,500 like everyone else. And maybe I started off like 13, maybe you started off like 16, who knows, right? I think our family had, you know, socioeconomics, it was close enough though, right? But say you start off with 500 and everyone else is starting off 1500. That's what we're talking about in this community. And can they make it with $500? Yeah, they can make it, but they have to have a lot better roll of the dice than us, and much fewer are going to be making it. And you see that a lot, like people will point to examples like, well, this person got out of the projects and did this extraordinary thing. Yeah, they rolled the dice pretty good. And they got a lot of luck was involved in that. A lot of luck's always involved, but it's just not a level playing field. It's really not. If that makes any sense at all.
It does. And you know, Greg, it's sad to me though, because I think about some of the opportunities that other people get. So like, if you go away to college, you return home without any issue. Nobody views you any differently. You don't worry about being home and the dangers you might get into while you're home, and you go back to, you'd be able to go back to college without an issue. It'd be so much different if we were from a different community and if our backgrounds were different.
And how they know what they know. What they know is you're an outsider now. You're not part of this community anymore. And so it's almost, to succeed is almost frowned upon.
Yeah.
And so it's, so when we're talking about healing generational trauma, it's not the individual that can do it. It's like you got to fix the whole system, whether that's a family system or like a cultural system.
And you know, this is an idea that's this last part that we're talking about that I really do believe will change over time, because we are becoming a more accepting society that other populations of people can have some success. I just know it's very tough. It's not an easy road for a lot of people. And I just want to acknowledge that, because I think that, you know, while I'm sitting here saying like internalized oppression and people distancing themselves away from their culture, away from their own communities and learn helplessness, while I'm saying all these things are part of it, I also realize that breaking the cycle and, you know, combating these negative coping skills is super tough. And it takes a lot of resilience, which people have, just not everybody realizes the amount of resilience they have. So we talked about coping, and I think there's two big ways that people cope in a negative fashion. First off is denial, which is refusing to acknowledge that trauma happened. You might see that as like a family secret in a home, or like, we just don't talk about that. You know, and then there's the other one, which is minimization. So it's ignoring the impact of the trauma, making the traumatic experience appear smaller than it really is. Trying to think of a good example of that, but it's, you know, it's like we have this family member that did something really terrible, and it's like that he's around all the time, and we just pretended, you know, wasn't that bad, and like, oh, it's okay, he can be around the kids or whatever. It's, don't worry about it. So it's just like kind of minimizing what happened and how that impacts everybody around that person and all of that. I don't know if that was the best example, but I was kind of struggling.
Hey, it was an example.
It was one. So with this concept, we're talking typically about like the older generations and how they start to set the stage for how we know and learn how to process our emotions, right? Because how do we learn anything? We learn it from our parents, our grandparents, the people who are caretakers, right?
Yeah.
So if they're hiding emotions and, you know, acting as if nothing happens and internalizing emotions, what am I learning? How am I learning how to cope with them?
It's exactly right. Like, how do we, and so this isn't just generational trauma. This is like all of our core beliefs. This is how, like, there's this quote, and I saw it recently, but I don't know where, but it was a Wordsworth quote. And it said, the child is father to the man, which I thought was really interesting. It makes a lot of sense, where it's just saying that like the person that you develop into as a child is going to be the adult you are.
Okay.
And so it's those things that you're learning early on in life, those things that you're seeing, the things you're picking up on, how people handle things, how you know what you know, that's going to follow you your entire life. So this is, so generational trauma follows you because it happens when you're young and it stays with you forever. And you could call that, when it's maladaptive, we call it generational trauma. But when it's positive, we just call it, I don't know, nothing.
Yeah.
learning.
And the part about this that makes it generational trauma is, guess what? It's not going to just affect me that my family didn't know how to process emotions correctly, or they internalized a lot of stuff. It's going to affect, if I have kids, it's going to affect them. And then it's going to affect their kids.
Right.
And that's where we start to get into the generational aspect of this.
And that's when you hear people say, like, I'm going to be the one. And we say it a lot too, like, you could break the cycle here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know? And sometimes the person that breaks the cycle, unfortunately or fortunately, it depends on how you look at it, can't really be a part of that system. And that system is sometimes your family.
Yeah.
So if you're going to break the system and you're going to change and you're going to start a new family and give them different beliefs and values and a way to live their life, sometimes you have to leave your family behind.
Yeah.
That's a tough choice.
I can't imagine how difficult that must be. So the trauma is essentially, it's dealt with by older generations within a family, and that sets the stage for how the traumatic events are or should be coped with. So that's how we start to pass it down. A lot of times people don't get the help when they need it, and that's what causes them to have these maladaptive coping skills, which we've talked about already. And that's how they transfer those negative emotions onto their kids. So my, you know, I witnessed substance abuse in the home. There's alcoholism. I'm probably more likely to dabble with substances myself when I'm struggling with things and I need to cope. You know, it's that kind of idea that it's just, it's like a cycle almost.
Yeah.
I wanted to give a larger example, or a pretty significant example of generational trauma. All right. So this one is the residential schools in Canada, which we have as a society here in North America. I think we've learned a lot about those, or we've at least heard the terrors of those over the last few years, especially. But these actually have existed from about the 1870s until the last one closed in 1996, as far as I'm aware.
Wow.
So do you have any familiarity with these, Greg?
So I don't, but what I do have, something I looked at when I was talking about generational trauma, and it's just super quick, is just the Indigenous women in America and the alarming rates that they are going missing.
Yes.
And so just, I just wanted to say a couple, and you want to talk about changing your core beliefs, or what their thoughts of the world and what kind of place the world is must be when you listen to just a couple of these statistics. And so they are statistically more likely to get raped or murdered than go to college. That is wild, right? 84% of Indigenous women have experienced some kind of violence, and more than half of them have experienced sexual assault. That, I mean, what can you say to that? That's something that needs to be addressed. And that's a cultural thing. Like, right. Why is that happening? So, I mean, there's a lot of whys that have to be answered to get to the bottom of that. So I'm sorry, I don't want to like interrupt your, I just thought that I just thought that had to be said. If we're going to talk about Native Americans or natives in general.
Yeah. So for the residential schools, these were schools for Indigenous and Native children between the ages of 4 to 16. And they attended for either a duration of 10 months, of which was their academic year, but some also lived in the schools year round. And the goal was to assimilate the natives into society. This was deemed like the most effective way to civilize the Indigenous people. And the time was spent there to do academics, to do religious prayer and tasks, because this was financially, the Canadian government was responsible for this. And they were operated with partnership with Anglican, Catholic, Methodist, and Presbyterian churches. So these were run by, you know, all church members, but it was also the Canadian government who was financially responsible for it. It's estimated that 150,000 Indigenous children attended these schools. That is an astonishing number. 150,000.
That's like wiping a culture out, though.
Yeah,
you know, it's like erasing. It reminds me of those camps that, like, when they try to, like, if you're a homosexual, they want to send
conversion,
you there. Yeah, conversion camp. And this is like, you're taking their culture away. And that's everything they relied upon. You take away someone's culture and it's like, what do they have left?
Do you remember the book by Chinua Achebe, When Things Fall Apart?
No.
Okay. Well, part of it is when they start to, you know, become colonized. And this is the struggle they have, is like they're being introduced religion, they're being taught how to speak, you know, different language. Basically, they're losing their culture, and the main character in that book can't deal with it. So he takes his own life instead. And, you know, just thinking about that, how that must trouble them to have that feeling like, I should be ashamed of who I am. I have to become like the white man. I no longer can speak my own language.
Well, your culture informs your values, and your values inform your choices, and your choices are who you are as a person.
Right.
If you take that away from someone, you've taken their identity.
Exactly.
You've taken their existence away.
Yes. You're already ahead of me right here. So yeah, that's exactly what it is. They're taking away their identity. So in 1920, just a few historical facts, there was amendments to the Indian Act, which made it mandatory for every Indian child to attend these schools. In 1933, legal guardianship of children attending the schools was assumed by the principals of the school and upon forcible surrender of legal custody by parents. This is why this is so crazy, Greg, is like your parents went to this school.
Yeah.
They went through the torture of all the things that happened at these schools. And then they had to send their kids to the school knowing what they were sending them to, but they didn't have a choice.
You know what school is probably like too? Have you ever seen Matilda? That's that's what all the principals were like.
Oh, it's yeah. Like, yeah. It was bad.
It's like Matilda minus the magic. No magic. And then so they teach you.
If you're a parent, you're forced to bring your kids to these schools or you'll have repercussions, legal repercussions.
And your culture, if you're a parent, you've already been through the school and your culture and your values have all been stripped away from you. So you think on some level you're doing the right thing. You've been conditioned to believe you're doing the right thing for them, but you're just destroying your own culture, like generation by generation. It's really sad.
And I'm sure that there's some awareness too that like, oh no, I do not want to send my child to this, but if I don't, I'm gonna, you know, be arrested or worse, who knows what they'll, you know, what they might do. Because their lives are honestly not valued. They're not viewed as valuable as the surrounding population there at the time. So in the schools, here's a few of the horror stories of things that happened.
This is already a horror story. I was thinking like the Monopoly example. It's like they're playing Monopoly, but then when they start, they owe $500.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah,
like terrible. Yeah, it's
so they were forbidden to speak their Aboriginal language and required to speak either French, English, or you know something else. No, I think it was just French or English, and it was vilification of their cultural conditions. They were required to adopt the religious denomination of the school. So they were forced to pray the style consistent with the school, regardless of what their beliefs were. They were forced to have haircuts or a shaved head. They used toxic chemicals to clean their hair and their skin. They were forced to shower. And these were like, we're talking about little kids. Like I said, you know, this was very young. They're going there as well. So no access to baths or anything like that. Forced to wear uniforms. Lack of nutritious diet, insufficient quantities of food. Sometimes they were served spoiled food. They were segregated based on their gender. So if you went in there with a sibling that was the opposite gender, you were separated with no contact. Sexual assaults were happening. There was forced abortions. Oh, electrical shock was used. And I heard some horror stories about how it was almost used for entertainment value. So like officials would come in and they would have the kids in there and they would start to electrical shock them. And while everybody's laughing and watching the show, really, really disturbing.
Like this is like reminding me of like Mengele and experimenting on concentration camps, yeah. Like prisoners. It's just seeing people as less than. You have to do some mental gymnastics to allow yourself to see another human being as less than or something other than yourself.
Absolutely.
It's horrible.
They were force fed their own vomit when they were sick.
My uncle Ray almost did that to me though.
Oh geez.
Yeah. Like he would always say, if you don't finish your food and you throw up, you're going to have to eat that too.
Ugh.
So, I mean, I've been through some stuff too, but keep going. I'm just kidding.
Exposure to freezing outside temps with improper clothing, withholding of medical attention, exposure to contagious illness. Students with tuberculosis weren't segregated. So if you were sick, you were expected to just resume your day. You couldn't go lay down. You had to be around everybody else while everybody else was exposed to you. You know, they used racist language, which over time we've learned that can have impact on a person's mentality and impact their brain
the
functioning.
Worth, like their
fits. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And they withheld any presents and letters from families.
Yeah, I can't stand that. For whatever reason, that one always, we talked about like withholding presents before, and that's for whatever reason. I know you're listing some horrific things here, but and I think you're probably going to keep going, right?
Well, then they had their way. Then that was like just the conditions, and then their way of disciplining the kids. So they would stick needles into their tongues for speaking their own language. They would use the leather straps to hit them, you know, in various parts of their body. They would beat them with fists, burn and scald hands. They would inflict the beatings until they were unconscious. starving, shaming, public beatings of naked children, public strip search, genital search, sexual abuse, locking in closets, cages, and basements. So why this fits into generational trauma? Well, we already expressed how, like, your parents went to this.
Yeah.
And now they have to send you to this and you just kind of deal with it, right? Because guess what? It's the law. We have to go.
So, well, no, Dave. And it's even beyond that too. So it's like this happens, right? And then the generation after generation after generation, to the, even when this is long forgotten, the things learned and the way that your body has sort of adapted to the hypervigilance and the trauma that happened to you, and that's been passed down after. You don't even have to know why you're acting the way you act, the way or why you have this view of the world and yourself and others. Like, you don't know where it comes from anymore, but this is where it came from. And this is like a great example, an extreme example. Thanks, Dave, for all that, of generational trauma. I mean, it's a perfect example. This is dark.
So, I mean, some of the themes that I took out of this, the reservation schools, is, you know, obviously PTSD, which we were talking about left and right here.
Yeah.
The shame and rejection of your own culture and the lack of identity, which we've already hit on. The lack of ability to express yourself. You are told how to communicate. You're told when to communicate. I didn't mention that in there, but one of the accounts that I listened to, it was a firsthand account of someone who went to the school. They actually told you when you can talk and when you can't talk. And how he saw that impact himself and his own father was like, they didn't know how to express themselves. They lost the, it became a thing that you just didn't know. No longer, it was like no longer just free will to communicate. It was like, I communicate when I'm told to communicate. And think about how much of like, how we use expression, how we use our communication to get out our feelings, to tell people what we're thinking. And that's not something that just comes naturally to them anymore because they've been brainwashed to understand that I don't have the ability to just freely communicate.
Wow.
I also have to just point out, like, you know, they're going 10 months of this at such a young age. So there's no compassion, there's no nurturing. And you got to wonder, does that start to cause some resentment of your family? When you're being walked to this school, knowing the conditions you're about to step into or not knowing, and then finding out and knowing that they walked you to that school.
Yeah.
I wonder, I don't know that one for sure, but that was a question that came to my head.
Wow. That's an intense one.
So, you know, there's stereotypes and you mentioned this in the beginning, and I think this is interesting. There are stereotypes of cultures, right?
Right.
Like of maladaptive coping skills that certain cultures have.
Right. And you can imagine why, like, the natives would start drinking, you'd be abusive. Yeah. There's a lot of, like, I just was talking about that. There's a ton of abuse. Where do you think that came from? It was learned through. So that's why I always say that thing where if you know someone's story, you can't hate them. So there's people all around the world that do all kinds of like rotten things that we can't understand. And we just judge them for like, why are you the way you are? And the sad thing is, if you go back far enough, like, you find out.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody is like intrinsically, you know, mean or wants to do harm to people. I think this is something that it's learned and is, it's got to be something in the DNA or it really does.
You know, there's a lot of thought about like, so in here in North America, like, we have the native population that lives on like reservations, and there's stereotypes about like alcoholism, poverty, things like that, right? That's kind of like a general stereotype that's not a great view to have of a population, but it's kind of like what we assume to exist in there. Yeah. And like, we think, like, obviously, you know, this is residential schools in Canada, but we have our own examples. Like, you were talking about the, you know, the percentage of women who have been trafficked or disappear of their population. We think about colonization that happened and the massacres that have happened. And we think about this idea of wanting to hang on to your culture, but like, at what cost? And we talked even about the, you know, the projects and, you know, how do you just grow from that? How easy is it for someone to just leave and, you know, ascend in society? It's tough.
It's tough.
And what you're talking about, why people stay in those conditions, you know?
we sit here, or people say like, oh, the Native community, they're, you know, like you're saying, like alcohol abuse and poverty. Well, if you look at those two things, I mean, you've given them PTSD for generations. So what they're adapting through alcohol, and we're, you know, judging them for it, but we've created that. And it's not just that, it's the poverty. So culturally, their wealth was something very different than ours. Their wealth was their land, the farming, the, you know, nature. It was like sort of a very different culture. So they viewed wealth a lot differently than we do. And what do? We took that. So we're calling,
and then we took impoverished.
Yeah. They're impoverished. Yeah. Well, I wonder why that is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, we're judging this, there's stereotypes that we created.
Yeah.
And stereotypes are created as an and it's some kind of adaptation. Wow. So, I mean, I wish I could even, I can't even touch with my example, what you did with yours. Cause that's just, and you know, in fact, like, I mean, maybe I should just go through mine quickly, because I think on some level it's similar. And the only reason why I picked the group that I did, the culture that I did, is because I was always fascinated by this culture. So I'm talking about Appalachia. I never even know.
Appalachia?
Appalachia, maybe. So I was fascinated with this culture, but probably for all the wrong reasons, you know, probably through pop culture, the movie Deliverance, Wrong Turn. I'm sure you're familiar with that movie, right?
Oh, I love that movie.
Right. So it's like these stereotypes of, you know, feuds, like, what would you say? Like, poverty again, inbreeding, unfortunately. Yeah. And when I was researching this young, when the internet was young, I had such a confirmation bias that I assumed that was going on almost exclusively there. Cause I would put in like inbreeding in Appalachia. And of course you're going to find it, right? You don't look for anything else, but this is a group.
Can you tell us what your mom's reaction was when she looked at your Google search history?
I know. What is this guy doing? I found all kinds of stuff. Like I found that there was inbreeding, of course, probably like everywhere else in the world. There was a family that was completely blue. Did you know about this? There was like a blood disorder that it's very rarely passed down, but if you keep it very much in the family, like the whole family turned blue. I mean, this is a true story, but I'll get into that in a little bit. So this was early on, this was a large population of Scotch-Irish that emigrated to, you know, the Pennsylvania area in the early 17th century. So they were like the last to sort of migrate over there. And whenever you're the last group to migrate, I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, what color or where you're from. It's like the last group of people to get there. The most recent group, it's always kind of treated the worst, right? So they over time, they withdraw into the mountains. And these people were Scotch-Irish. There was a lot of, you know, African slaves. There was a lot of, they're just like rough and tumble people, like strong people. They were self-sufficient. I mean, you had guys like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. This is who was, you know, like the first, you know, people living around there. And they sort of always did their thing. Like I said, the self-sufficiency is key. They were anti-tax and the government was always kind of wanting money from them. And they were, in their mind, they're like, you pushed us away and pushed us away and pushed us away. And now you want something from us. So then as time went on, there was this economic boom. And that came in the shape of mines and lumber. And that was great for the people that worked there. They were self-sufficient and they developed these great family values where it was just family and work was important. And so when the companies were like, we're just going to take care of you and pay you with food and place to live. So all this time during this economic growth, there was no real wealth acquired in Appalachia, right?
Yeah.
So then you take away the mines, because coal doesn't become, it's not the way we all heat our homes anymore, right? And it's not as used as widely as it was before. And lumber, not using, there's all kinds of regulations and everything like that. So you take that stuff away and now you have present day Appalachia where people are poverty stricken, you know? So this is sort of like around the same idea. You know what I'm saying, Dave? Where
yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
you push these people away, we push them away. We traumatize them with the way we treat them. And then we're like, why are you, all the people in Appalachia are poverty stricken. It's because they were exploited by big business and the government.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and when I, an interesting thing is when I was in the Navy, I had the opportunity to visit in visit Kentucky. And I have to admit, I was like, are we going to see, I'm like 20 years old, are we going to see in-bed people? And the person, and we didn't. No, but I mean, the culture itself, it just made me more fascinated with it. And there's this photographer, Shelby Lee Adams, who just takes these pictures of the people in Appalachia and just really brings something across that you don't really see unless you view those pictures. It's a culture there. If you know them and if you meet them, it's like you can't hate them. You have to know where someone's coming from to sort of understand them. And I just like to talk about that group because I, for whatever reason, am very fascinated with that culture. Do you have any connection with that?
I mean, to be honest with you, it's not a culture that I've really thought much about or like digged in too much about. It's very fascinating.
It is very fascinating. And I'm sorry, I feel like I went through it pretty quick, but that's because there are things, when I think of cultural or generational trauma, I think of micro examples. I'm not always thinking of the huge examples. I'm thinking of like familial stuff. You know, as parents, we pass down our worldview, even things like racism, that's all learned. Our family is how we know what we know. And you can see that generational trauma is how stereotypes are developed. It's survival. It's adaptations that we have essentially get judged for. And it's how our core beliefs and our assumptions about the world, ourselves, our future, and other people. And of our core belief, you know, it creates these irrational core beliefs. And if our core beliefs are irrational or true, that's damaging and perpetuating for future generations.
Absolutely. Right? And yeah. I even think about how modern day, like, it's great that we're living in a time where people are way more open about emotions and feelings, but we still do deal with certain cultures where it's not the norm to talk about your emotions or to talk about, you know, mental health, for example. Like we see that all the time where we're talking about it, like in the family, it's just not something you do. You don't really talk about what you're going through. And then I think about some of the issues going on in current day where I'm glad that people have, it's like more accepted for the most part, but some cultures are still going to struggle with this. You know, look at some of the different things, the different hate speech that like COVID has brought to different cultures.
Right. Right.
You know, passing blame on specific cultures and populations of people for saying they're responsible for any aspect of what we've been through and how that's going to impact the way that they start to navigate the world. When you're walking down the street and somebody is just saying really hateful and violent things towards you, you're going to become more alert, more hypervigilant. And then your kids are going to be impacted by seeing that. And
what's scary is it's like over time, people will not know why they hate this group of people. Yeah. Or even know where that irrational thought came from. It's just scary. And you know, it'd be another interesting episode. Where another clear example of generational trauma would be like gangs. That's got to be something that's a product of generational trauma, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So much of like subconscious behavior is shaped from trauma generations ago. Like, like little things, whether it's mannerisms, whether it's, you know, walking on the different side of a street from somebody, like just there's so much that is built, like behaviors that's built around racism, you know, violence directed towards a group of people. It's like just so inherent in our behavior day to day and how some people view the world based on the way that, you know, the community that they belong to, the population that they belong to, their cultural background.
And even again, I have to talk about like families because, you know, core beliefs or self-worth. Even in families, it doesn't just have to be bad. It could be like too good too. You know, when I'm thinking of like these, like every 80s movie has like these rich, like jerks. Yeah. And it's like they have cognitive distortions, which are just basically the mental filters, the way we look at things. And it's like irrational. It makes us, you know, feel bad about ourselves normally. But then there's these positive cognitive distortions too, which we all kind of, you know, you might be thinking irrationally too good of yourself. Like even if I ask you, Dave, like, what percentage of drivers are you better than? Like, you know what I mean? You might be like,
I would say a high percentage, but yeah, right. I would have a lot of people disagreeing with me.
But that means, so like, that's dangerous too, because then like when you do get in a car accident, you're going to be like, well, that must've been your fault. Like I'm in the 80th percentile of driver.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can see how that, like, even thinking to like
having
that. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, there's so much of this that, you know, our upbringing and our, the way we think and the way we are because of these things that we're not even really talking about. It's yeah. So, I guess it's like how, no matter how adaptive or maladaptive the traits or worldview you absorb in childhood, that's just going to determine the rest of your life. That's what puts a lot of pressure on parenting.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's like that, you know, we said that earlier, like the child is father to the man, like whatever you do to your kids. And I mean, look out for mine, probably. I mean, it's hard to pay attention to so many at once. Yeah,
but you know, Greg, well, that's true. You probably lose a few hair in there.
Yeah.
You know,
but he just learned something bad. He just absorbed something bad. You know what I mean?
The thing with all of this stuff, though, is like we're talking about it. So it's in our awareness now. It's in our peripheral. And we get, like, whether we agree with these things or not, like concepts that people, you know, cling to, or they think, oh, that's just a trend or whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. Now it's in their head and they're going to start to think about it. And they're going to start to think about how they're impacting their kids. Yeah. Whereas generations ago, they wouldn't have been something they would have thought about. And they weren't thinking about how their behavior is going to shape their kids' behavior in such a way. Like, as far as how they cope with things, as you know, like the idea of teaching your kids how to handle a situation has always been there, but how like your coping skills get passed on to your kids.
Yeah.
And like, some people don't even know their own coping skills or why they're like
a picture is worth a thousand words. Your kids are going to pick up on what you do, not what you say.
Yeah.
Even though you want the opposite to be true.
Absolutely.
And it's like this, there's a very like luck of the draw thing to this too. Like the Germans have a word that's called Dasein, and it's just like thrown into existence. So like we're all thrown into a time, like meaning like a time period, a family, a culture, and we can't choose those circumstances at all. But maybe at some point we'll be able to understand we can control our reaction to it or our attitudes in that situation. And I mean, that's all we can really hope for. But even that's going to be tough.
Yeah. Can you go back to cultural capital, which you were supposed to remind me about?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
What was the definition for that again?
So cultural capital is just, it's essentially our assets, but like our social assets. So education, intellect, even the way we dress and talk, Dave. And those are the things that, you know, if you're, sometimes you see, like, if you, like, I remember the movie Titanic and they were like, oh, we're not wealthy anymore. We have to marry this guy. But the only reason why you have a chance to marry the guy is because of your cultural capital. Like, you've got no money left, but you've got, I don't know, breeding. I don't know. Is this, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, just the way you're acting, the way you're talking, the access you have is an asset in and of itself.
So the reason why this, when you said that definition earlier, it stuck out to me is it really struck me how it fits into the idea of the residential schools. It fits into the idea about the projects. It even fits into the idea about Appalachia. There's stereotypes about, or like not even stereotypes, there's an inability for them to ascend in society based on the factors that their environment or their culture.
Even an accent.
But like, so that idea of like somebody distancing themselves away from their community, maybe not dressing like their people in their community would, you know, changing their mannerisms, trying to speak in a different way, like you were saying, an accent or even just the dialect or right. The way that they, you know, form the grammatical forming of sentences. It's like you have to leave your culture and your identity behind if you want to ascend. So this idea of cultural capital almost feels created by somebody who's advanced in society, yeah. Who has all the things that are deemed quote unquote ideal, right?
Like gatekeepers.
Yeah.
You know, like
I don't want to get into the whole race thing because I know this is obviously something that some people are probably like, I totally get what you're saying. And then other people are kind of like, oh,
and it's not even so much. So Appalachia, right? I mean, that's not even, those are
Sure.
Overwhelmingly white. And they're going to be
overwhelmingly
white. They're going to be marginalized too, right?
Way too much, guys.
So, all right, let me ask, because I know we're definitely going to be getting to the end of this thing, but I am curious, you know, I don't want to ask if you have any generational trauma, but I'm just curious if you can recall anything or if you can think about anything you picked up through your upbringing, because there's a couple that I can think about for myself and that has sort of shaped my worldview. And do you want me to go first to show you like an example of what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Okay. So I remember, I have two very distinct memories. I have a memory of going out to breakfast with my dad and telling me to not drink. He ordered me a coffee milk and the waitress put a straw in it. And he took the straw and put it on the table and said, straws are for wimps. And I had to have been 4 years old. And I was just like, okay, noted. So, and then another thing to kind of piggyback on that, I remember being really young. It's probably one of my first memories. I went to hug my grandfather's leg and he pushed me back gently, not rough or anything, but he stuck his hand out and he said, men shake hands. Had to have been four, maybe. So, I mean, so now like I've noticed about myself, like, strength and like maybe like being like a toughness has whether I want that to be it or not, it's always been so important to me. Like I don't want to be seen, I don't want people to see weaknesses in me. I don't want and it's like it's followed me around. And damned if I don't drink out of straws. Unless it's a nice coffee. And I said, you know what? The cycle ends here, baby.
That's a great example. And you know, it's funny because I can totally see that. Like about you now that you say that, but like, I wouldn't have known why.
It's funny, right? How like why we are the way we are is like it's these simple things that my father or my grandfather didn't think about it 3 seconds after. And here we are, I won't say exactly how many years later, but many years later, and it's shaped a part of my existence. It's shaped who I am. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So you can see how like a trauma where it's necessary to make an adaptation for your brain, that's got to stick with you forever.
Sure.
I passed that down to my kids, I'm sure, on some level.
That's pretty wild.
It is.
I honestly can't think of, or I mean, I'm sure they're there and
there's
a lot
something
of,
that happened.
There's a lot of things you, I just
like
wouldn't
horror. Like how do they think the horror thing happened?
How did the horror thing happen?
Yeah. Like, I mean, there must've been something, right?
I mean, I have a story of how, like, I think I got into it, but I don't know that like it ties into generational trauma. It was like, a lot of it's always nostalgia stuff, you know.
So you could tell us. I mean, I honestly
don't know. I have memories of watching it with my grandmother and enjoying and finding it funny how she would watch horror movies with her hands like covering her eyes, but like open her fingers were open so she could see peek through them. But for some reason that gave her comfort, I guess.
Yeah.
Where sometimes she would watch it from a mirror that faced the living room so she could see it through a mirror. So it was always this idea of having something like shielding her from the TV. And I remember like watching Psycho and some other black and white films at their house. And I loved that experience. And then when I was younger, I was watching like TV and like Freddie would be on and stuff like that. So
you almost robbed us of that beautiful. I mean, you really put an image there with like your grandma watching horror with your grandmother and her hands open. Like we all can picture that, like the open hands over the face where like, I mean, I love that image. I think that's so cool. Like, I can't believe you almost deprived us of that. That's.
I mean, I think about traits that I have that I know are like recurrent in my family. Like my grandmother was anxious, nervous. My mom is anxious, nervous. She's going to listen to this and probably hate that I said that. I'm anxious, nervous. So like, I think about that and I'm like, obviously that's something kind of passed down. And what caused my grandmother to be so anxious, nervous? I don't know. And I wish I could ask her, but I can't. So that's unfortunate. But like, whatever it was, has definitely been passed on. My dad's very conflict avoidant. And I'm super conflict avoidant if you haven't learned that yet. So in like, those are traits that there's probably rationale of why, and they're very significant traits in me. So yeah, I just don't know the, like,
well, that's because it happened so long ago.
And
right. And whatever it was,
no one, people don't talk about it, right? Yeah. No one's like, I'm anxious because of this reason. And like, I don't like conflict because of this happening.
I mean,
like,
that your grandmother was calling it neurosis when she was having it. You know what I mean? Like, that's how long ago that shit was going on.
Sure.
So I mean, it's, yeah.
But these are things that like we now, and like the good thing I can do and is I can be aware of it. And I can like tie it to like, oh, this was in my family. Like I get this from my mom. And I try to work on it with myself. Cause like those kind of things can be really challenging. Like the avoidance of conflict is way more challenging than my anxiety.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, ooh, I don't want to get into that. And that's sometimes you need to.
Yeah. You know? And sometimes the opposite, like, so I enjoy conflict. And so the opposite of that would be, so maybe we could, you know, rub off on each other a little bit there. Hopefully that came off clear. And one last thing, just to break that up. I hate to say that Teen Wolf might be the most relatable and important movie of all time, because damned if that isn't generational trauma.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Amazing reference to that again.
How many more times can we use that movie?
No. But it's a lot of our topics probably tie into there's generational trauma. And off the top of my head, I can't think of anything.
Generational trauma or whatever you want to call it, because trauma is just the perception of some event, right? That informs your core beliefs. Your core beliefs are going to inform your automatic thoughts. And that's going to do a lot for your mental health and what state of person you are. Yes. It's just, this is the building blocks of your identity. It's wild. And we can see that.
It really is also the best reason why, if you have trauma, or especially complex trauma, if you've dealt with those kind of traumas, you really should try to seek help.
And you know what else, though, Dave? We should also, like you're saying, ask those three important questions. Like, you know, because you might be thinking of the world in a certain way that you don't even realize. So we might want to ask, like, what are your thoughts on the world? Is it a safe place? Is it a dangerous place? What are your thoughts about yourself? And what are your thoughts about other people? And that's going to tell us a lot about where, like, you know, it might even tell you a lot about where you are with this generational trauma thing, like how you know what you know, how you view the world. And then if you can kind of make that view a little more rational, that's going to affect your thoughts and that's going to affect your mood, I think. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Greg, this was a heavy, heavy topic. Yeah. I'm exhausted.
I'm so tired.
I hope that we were able to kind of give this the justice that it deserves, and that we were able to, I mean, the main thing I really wanted to do was to be able to express this concept in a way that, like, hopefully doesn't offend anyone, mm-hmm. but is just like helps people understand what it's all about. Because like, I hear people sometimes hear phrases like generational trauma, or, you know, other things that are like more present in society and people are talking about it more, and they kind of roll their eyes, or they just like, what's that? You know, another thing, you know, another coming up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, no, this is a thing. This is real.
100%. Yeah. I don't know if there's anything as real. This is as real as it gets.
Yeah. And, you know, and it just, you know, it's relatable for all of us. So hopefully, you know, no matter who you are, hopefully you're able to connect to this topic somehow and find it helpful in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And this might be our last sign off as modern therapists.
No.
Yep. All but right. We'll figure it out.
Signing off. Two therapists.
Wait, I don't know. Is that it? Is that where we're going with? Okay, no. All right.
Two dope therapists, guide to nothing.
It's not bad. I like the curious. No, that's not good either.
Curio. Was that what you said
earlier? I sent that message to you and you ignored it. So obviously.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to entertain that.
Well, it's not even like I know these words. I'm looking up definitions. And then if the word's okay, I'm like, that's pretty cool. Yeah. All right, bye. All right, people don't need this. So let's get out of here, Dave.
Congratulations, everyone. That's just a little taste of what our text messages are like.
Yeah.
All right. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to us ramble. And we hope you enjoyed this. We'll be back next week with a new topic and a new name. We'll see you then. Good night.
It's in progress, baby. Under a new name, new attitude.